"Ridquid's stuffed in Laddo's sock drawer upstairs," he says casually. Jen's breath catches. "Pete, I've been saving, I swear."
"Liar."
His hand moves fast, tangling in her hair and yanking her head back. Pain sears through her scalp, but she barely registers it because Brody is wailing now, his cries splitting the air. She claws at Pete's grip, but he shoves the heel of his hand against her mouth.
"Shut it,"
he hisses, his face inches from hers.
"You don't get to talk until I say you can."
Brody's sobs turn frantic, his little hands reaching for her. Jen forces herself to go still. She won't scream. She won't give Pete a reason to turn on him. Her breath comes in short, ragged bursts.
"Okay, I lied," she chokes out. "But the rest of the money, it's for Brody."
Pete yanks harder, and she feels the sharp sting of hair ripping from her scalp. A yelp escapes before she can stop it. Brody screams louder, crawling away in terror. Then, just as suddenly, Pete lets go, shoving her back. She stumbles, catching herself against the sofa.
"We're leaving this dump now."
Jen's chest heaves.
"Leaving? To go where?"
He doesn't answer. Jen grabs Brody and bolts up the stairs, clutching him tightly in her arms. His little fists grip her sweater, his face buried in her shoulder, his sobs shaking his small body. Pete's footsteps thunder behind them.
"Jen!"
he roars.
"Get back here!"
She lunges inside the bathroom, slams the door shut and twists the lock just as Pete's fist pounds against the wood.
"Open the door!"
he shouts. The handle rattles violently.
"You're making this worse for yourself, you stupid..."
He cuts himself off, breathing hard. Jen staggers back against the sink, still gripping a now sobbing Brody, her whole body trembling. She barely registers her own shaking fingers as she fumbles for her phone in her back pocket. "Alicia." She taps the screen, hitting the video call. It rings. Once. Twice.
"Come on, come on,"
she pleads as Pete's frenzied banging and shouting continues. Then Alicia's face appears.
"Jen?"
Alicia's voice is instantly sharp with concern.
"What the? You've got to help us!"
Jen gasps, her voice raw with terror.
"Please, he..."
A loud crack splinters through the room as Pete slams his full weight against the door. Brody wails in her arms, his cries high and panicked. The phone shakes in Jen's grip as she stumbles backward, but she keeps the camera aimed at the door.
"Alicia, I'm sorry, I..."
The door bursts open. Pete storms in, eyes wild, chest heaving. Jen reels back, clutching Brody tight, but Pete moves faster. He lunges, snatching the phone from her hand. It slips from his grasp, tumbling to the floor, landing face up. Jen watches, frozen with fear, as Pete picks it up, turns it over in his palm, then lifts it to his face. His eyes lock onto the screen, onto Alicia. A slow, smug smile stretches across his lips against the backdrop of Brody's wails.
"Bye-bye,"
he murmurs, wiggling his fingers at the camera. And then he ends the call. Chapter 29. Alicia. I stand rooted to the spot, the phone still clutched in my hand like it's the only thing keeping me upright. My mind buzzes with white noise, but I can't seem to make a sound. The world around me blurs at the edges, narrowing to the screen that's still glowing in my palm. I barely register the ache in my fingers from gripping it too hard. I can't stop replaying the sound of my son crying, my sister pleading, the face of the monster that just tore my world apart. Trent had just left the penthouse for more meetings when an incoming video call flashed across the screen. "Jen. Finally."
"Hey,"
I answered. But the second the screen loaded, my blood turned to ice. Chaos. Jen screaming, Brody wailing in the background, the camera shaking violently, the picture blurring as something crashes.
Jen!
I yelled, panic-stricken. What's happening? Jen shouting, a loud crash, Brody's terrified sobs, then the sound of splintering wood and heavy footsteps. Then her phone dropped, spinning as it hit the floor. The screen wobbled, and then Pete Scothern's face appeared. He stared directly into the camera, locking eyes with me. A slow, knowing smile spread across his lips.
Bye-bye,
he murmured. And then the call went dead. I have to call the police, tell them Scothern is in the house, that he is hurting Jen, but he's there right now, and the police will take too long. I bite my lip until I taste blood. I know what it is I must do. I pull up his number and press call.
Alicia, to what do I owe the pleasure? Have you...
I need your help. I try to keep my voice level, but it cracks. My sister and son are in trouble in Nottingham, Steve. There's a man, Jen's ex. She needs urgent help. Can you get someone round there?
You're supposed to deliver to me, sweetheart, not the other way around.
Betts chuckles, his smooth, sickly voice like oil on the end of the line. I force myself to breathe. She just called me. On video. This guy, he's a maniac. He's there in the house. Can you just send someone?
Calm down. He won't hurt them.
No, you don't understand. This is my sister's ex. He abused her and now he's... Hang on. What? He won't hurt them. He just said it like he knew what was happening.
Scothern is at the house. Yes, I'm aware.
The walls around me tilt. You're aware?
Scothern's a nasty piece of work, but seems your sister, Jen, she can't resist his charms. Made it easy for me to get him in there as a bit of insurance, should you bail on our agreement.
I'm calling the police. Right now, I'm...
No. Don't do that.
His voice is cold and commanding.
Involve the police and you'll never see your son and sister again. He won't hurt them unless I give him the nod. And I won't give him the nod if you can guarantee me some decent information before...
You can't do this. Tears of fury and terror spill down my cheeks. You can't.
Oh, but I can, my lovely. I can, and I am doing this. I'll send somebody round there to calm things down, but you know exactly how to stop it. So my advice is to get busy and bring me something.
The line goes dead. Each minute I'm on the train stretches into an eternity as I stare out of the window at the same unfocused landscape, my mind cycling through every possibility. I'm trying to force myself to trust Betts when I have never, ever trusted a thing he said to me. But I have no choice. Him putting Pete Scothern in Jen's house smacks of the truth. It's exactly the kind of thing he'd do. Betts is probably the only man who can control Scothern. So when he tells me Pete won't hurt them, that he'll send someone round to calm things down, I have to believe him. Even though it seemed to me from the video call that Scothern already was hurting Jen. The train carriage rocks beneath me, too clunky, too slow. I'd grabbed my coat, stuffed the memory stick and folder I got from Trent's office into a large tote bag and called a cab to King's Cross, all on automatic pilot. I can't stop shifting. My fingers twitch, my eyes darting over every patch of countryside that rushes past the window. Every mile takes me closer to a house that might already be a crime scene. The Uber from Nottingham Station to Jen's house feels like it's crawling. By the time we get close, her voicemail box won't accept any more of my pleading messages. My nerves feel raw and jangling, but the hatred I feel for Betts and Scothern burns like fuel inside me, somehow propelling me on. Every time the car stops at a light, my foot taps uncontrollably. I'm willing us to move faster, my stomach churning with something heavy and sour. My fingers keep twitching toward my phone, but there's nothing I can do now until I get there. Then the driver slows right down.
Accident,
he murmurs. The flashing lights catch my eye first. Police cars, an ambulance, a growing knot of people gathering at the scene. As we crawl past, I see a car pulled awkwardly across the road, half up on the curb, its hazard lights blinking. I wind down my window as we pass a dazed-looking man talking to an officer, his hands flying around as he gestures wildly. Then I see it. A body on the ground. A man, his lifeless eyes wide and glassy, one side of his face bloody and mashed. A paramedic approaches with a pale blue blanket to cover the crumpled body. My breath catches. The knot in my stomach pulls tighter when I see what's lying close to the body's hand. My son's favorite toy. Flopsy Rabbit. No. No. Stop the car, I blurt out. You can drop me here. The driver hesitates, looks at me in the rearview mirror. Huh? Just stop, I shout. The second the car halts, I throw open the door and stumble out. My feet hit the pavement, and I hurtle a few steps to the accident scene. The flashing lights get brighter. Hey, you can't just go up there. A man's voice shouts behind me, but I don't stop. I push through the small crowd that's gathered, my heart pounding so hard I think it might burst. The closer I get, the more I can see. And then, there it is. The same angle I saw from the Uber. The blanket draped over the body, a smear of something dark and glistening on the asphalt. It can't be him. It can't be. Madam, you need to step back. I don't even register the officer's hand on my arm until I'm being pulled back, held in place while my eyes stay locked on the scene. The driver's still talking, his voice shaking. I couldn't stop, he just stepped out, just walked right into the road. Another officer bends down and pulls the blanket further over the body. The blood, the battered, unrecognizable side of his head. It's Pete Scodden. Dead. Here, just a street away from Jen's house. But my sister and son are nowhere to be seen. I can't move. I can't speak. My legs feel like they might give out. I abandon the Uber and run. When I get to Jen's, a strange stillness meets me, as if the entire street has stopped to hold its breath. There's no one around. The house looks the same from the outside. Nothing unusual. But something is very, very wrong. I ring the doorbell. I can hear the faint echo of it behind the door, but there's no movement. No telltale shadows of a harassed Jen approaching through the frosted glass. I circle around to the back door, peering through the window. Used breakfast dishes sit abandoned on the table, the plates smeared with crumbs, a cereal bowl tipped up. Spilled milk has dried in a puddle near Brody's tiny chair, and one of his toys, a bright red fire truck, lies on its side beneath the table. My stomach clenches. It's just not like Jen to leave things in such disarray. Not when it's just her and Brody. Why did alarm bells not ring before when I noticed this? I just put it down to Jen being exhausted, but this points to a clear fault line in what's happening within this house. I return to the front door and dig into my bag for the spare key she gave me when she moved in. My fingers fumble, but I manage to slot it into the lock and twist, pushing open the door. As I step inside, the silence hits me like a wall, thick, oppressive, unnatural. The house is not just empty. It feels completely devoid of any warmth or life at all, as if it stood empty for a while. Jen? I call, my voice breaking through the silence. Brody? There's no answer, just the cold echo of my own voice. I move through the hallway, each footstep muffled against the carpet. The sitting room is dim, the curtains half drawn. The sofa cushions are unfluffed, a blanket crumpled at one end. Inexplicably, Gerald Giraffe, the sculpture Brody loves that Jen keeps by the fireplace, lies discarded in the middle of the room. I make my way upstairs, my pulse thudding in my ears as I climb. The bathroom door is decimated, but there's nothing in here. No clues, so I move on. In Jen's bedroom, the wardrobe stands open, its contents spilling out haphazardly. clothes on hangers, but some twisted, mismatched, like they've been thrown back without thought. Then I see it. A man's jacket, slung over her velvet dressing table stool. Large, dark, and unmistakably masculine. A chill grips me as I touch the fabric. It's rough and heavy, the kind of thing Jen would never buy for herself. I've never seen it before, and it's out of place here. I turn slowly, scanning the room, although I'm not sure what I'm looking for. But when I walk a few steps toward the bedside table, I see a stack of mail. I reach down and pick up the top letter. It's marked for the attention of Mr. Peter Scothern. The address is here, Jen's new house, the place she came to escape him. Nausea rises in my throat, and the letter blurs before my eyes. Peter Scothern. Betts was telling the truth. He did send Pete here to convince Jen to give him another chance in case I stepped out of line. That other guy he sent out to ask questions about me and unnerve Jen was to send me a warning. What I hadn't known was Betts had the real enemy in place within. Scothern, living here with my son. Betts's cryptic words echo in my head. Sometimes the most interesting stuff happens a lot closer to home. You should ask your sister. Repeating those words silently in my head feels like a knife digging into my skull, slicing through any illusions I've had of Jen and Brody's safety, of ever escaping Betts and putting the past behind us. He'll always find a way to keep tabs on me. Scothern is the thug who put my sister in hospital with a broken arm and concussion, not to mention a litany of bruises and fractures over a number of years before that. He's the man she swore to keep away from, to never let near her again. The monster I helped her escape by putting up the money for the deposit so she could move away from her old area to this new place. A fresh start. Panic rises in me like a wave, and I clutch the bedpost, trying to reason with myself. Jen wouldn't have anything to do with Scothern. She wouldn't. And I'm doubly sure she'd never even consider it while she's looking after Brody. She'd never risk my son's safety by having a man like that around. Images flood my mind. Jen glancing nervously over her shoulder, her tense grip on Brody's arm, her evasive looks. Sometimes the most interesting stuff happens closer to home. You should ask your sister. Has he been here all along? Hiding in plain sight? My heart beats faster as I recall Brody's sleepless nights. That mark on his temple she said came from a tumble. His recent illness. I'm tearing through the rooms then, flinging open drawers, checking every corner, every surface. They're not here. Brody's nappy changing bag is missing. A set of his little dinosaur pajamas and his favourite blue jumper, gone. His favourite toy since he was a baby, Flopsy Rabbit. I close my eyes against the picture of it next to Scothern's dead, pale hand. I'm frantically scanning the house, trying to piece it all together, and it hits me like a punch to the gut. Jen's taken my son. Taken him somewhere and she hasn't told me because she's scared of what I'll say about Scothern. But if Scothern is dead, where are they? The last time I saw them, Scothern was breaking down the bathroom door to get to them. My hands shake when I sink onto the edge of the bed, the horror settling over me, cold and suffocating. Why didn't Jen call me and tell me what was happening way before this? Why didn't she ask for help if she needed it? But I know the answer to that. I'd seen our mother make the same flawed judgments time and time again. Jen didn't know Betts was behind Scothern's return. She believed every lie that left his vile lips, all the promises men like him make to the women who love them. Jen, just like Mum did with our loser of a dad, would have genuinely believed he'd changed and that he couldn't live without her. The images won't stop. Jen's bruises and darting eyes, Brody's restlessness before he fell ill, that angry red mark on his head, Jen's fearful glances at the door and around the room when I visited. It all makes sense now. She'd been watching out, all right. Not for Brody. but for any trace of Scothern that might betray her secret. If it's true, then all of it is a lie. Every strange look, every awkward silence, it's not just the stress and tiredness she claimed. It's pure, undiluted fear of him, and probably fear of my reaction if I discovered what she'd done. It was a fear she couldn't communicate, couldn't let out, because all this time he's been living here, in this house, with my son. Jen has protected Pete over me and over Brody's safety. All this happening while I languished cluelessly in the orbit with all its meaningless luxury. I crossed my arms and wrapped them around myself, my breath ragged and raging. The image of Brody's small, pale face flashes in my mind. A thousand questions spiral in my mind, each one worse than the last. Has Scothern hurt her? Hurt Brody? Before getting himself hit by a car, leaving them stranded and shut away somewhere. I could spit fire when I think of Betts. The lengths he's prepared to go to in order to get his dirty project approved and make himself more millions. No one matters to him. People are just interchangeable pawns in his business empire. Back downstairs, Jen's small, usually neat lounge is in disarray. Cold and stark without Brody and his toys. It feels like the walls are squeezing closer to me, as I picture Scothern looming over Jen, hurting her as he did before. And this time, with Brody caught in the crossfire. My eyes settle on the giraffe discarded on the floor. My eyes catch an unusual detail, and I move closer to see a smear of blood underneath it. But whose blood? Breathe. I tell myself, just breathe. My hands numb, I reach for my phone. I'm barely able to focus as I stare down at the screen, Jen's name highlighted on my contact list. I press the call button again, and it starts to ring. I'm alert to a muted noise, a ringing, right here next to me. I plunge my hand down between the cushions and my fingers close around cold metal. I pull it out and my heart plummets. It's Jen's phone. Chapter 30. Back on the train and an hour from London, I press my forehead to the cool glass, trying to steady my breathing. My pulse is an erratic drumbeat, my thoughts crashing over each other like waves. I can't slow down enough to think straight. Every breath scrapes against my ribs, tight and useless. I've called Betts at least half a dozen times, but it just goes through to voicemail. Did he send someone round there like he promised? The police. I could call them, explain everything. But how long would that take? And I think about Betts's warning. What if getting the police involved only makes everything even worse? I bite down on the inside of my cheek, fighting the urge to scream. I'm running out of time. Every option that occurs to me feels like I might be stepping off a cliff. I'll make sure you pay in ways you won't believe. Betts. He's the one to blame for this. The problem is, I have no proof that he's involved. I can't risk putting Jen and Brody in more danger. Then another possibility presents itself. Had Jen escaped from Scothern, taken Brody to safety quickly, just the two of them? The only thing I can be certain of is that Scothern is dead, and there's a sculpture smeared with blood on the living room floor. But whose blood? I look down at my phone on the train table, my thumb hovering over Trent's name. The idea of turning to him churns my stomach. I can only explain why I need help if I'm honest with him. But he's the only one with the power to help me quickly. I press the number and hold the phone to my ear. It goes straight to voicemail, and I realize he's probably still in meetings. I take a breath. Trent, it's me. Can you call me back ASAP, please? I need to speak to you. It's really urgent. I'm clutching the phone so tightly my knuckles ache. Brody's sweet face floats into my mind. The way he scowls when he's trying to focus, how he scrunches up his nose when he laughs. And Jen.
She was the one who promised to look after him while I lived in London. We swore an allegiance. Us three against the world. Bet sent Scothen to her. But ultimately, Jen betrayed me. After everything, she got herself involved with Scothen again. And now they're gone. The only two people I care about in this world. The train stops. People get off. New passengers get on. The carriage seems darker, the shadows longer and pressing closer. Betts didn't say he had them, but he didn't categorically deny it either. He admitted he sent Scothen there. He's the reason they're gone. The clock ticks louder, a hammer against my skull. Where is my son? And what if I'm already too late? Barry, the Orbit doorman, waves as I enter. But I barely notice. My legs are shaking as I rush through the revolving doors, clutching my bag to my chest.
Miss Alicia, Mr. Connors has just been looking for you.
I hear him call out, but I don't turn around. Just as I reach the lift doors, they open, and Eleanor steps out. Her sleek hair is pinned neatly at the nape of her neck, her expression calm as she scans my face.
Alicia, is everything okay?
Her voice is calm, but something snaps inside me and my eyes fill with tears.
Are you all right?
No, I'm cracking up, Eleanor, seriously. My voice wobbles and the words catch in my throat. I try to smile, to brush past her, but the tears spill over, hot and unstoppable. Eleanor puts a hand on my arm, her eyes narrowing with concern. Come on, she says firmly. Let's go upstairs. I want to make sure you're okay. I follow her back into the lift, my chest heaving, my head pounding. The ride up feels endless, even though it's only a few minutes. Eleanor doesn't say much, just a few murmured reassurances, but the weight of her hand on my arm is steadying, and I find myself feeling grateful I bumped into her. She takes the key card and punches in a floor. When it stops, I get out. This is not the penthouse floor, I say, looking around. I stare at the walls, the floor. Every piece of this palatial prison has started to look the same, like a hall of mirrors. The luxury morphing into a big blob of sameness that sparks off even more anxiety in me. I'm taking you to our apartment, Eleanor says firmly, somewhere you feel safe enough to talk. She leads me inside. It's a smaller living space, but it instantly feels lived in and real, unlike the penthouse.
Stay here, she says. Just take a few moments while I get you a glass of water.
Eleanor, my family are missing, I blurt out. I have a 2-year-old son. My sister's looking after him while I'm here in London. I've just been to the house and they've gone. And someone's dead who my sister knew, her ex. I pinch the top of my nose. I'm not making any sense. God, I've made such a mess of everything. Put the wrong people first, and now I don't know what to do. Eleanor hands me the glass of water and squeezes my hand.
Tell me what's happened. Tell me everything.
So I do.
You're saying that your sister's abusive ex is dead, but she's missing with your boy.
Eleanor frowns.
What do you think has happened?
I don't know. I feel so hopeless. On the way to Nottingham, after seeing and hearing what was happening on the video call, I felt sure he'd hurt them. But when I saw his body in the road and Jen and Brody were gone, who knows? I'm scared Steve Betts has them, or knows where they are.
But why would Betts have them?
Eleanor shakes her head.
I'm trying to keep up, Alicia, but it's hard to piece together.
So I tell her about my undercover work. I came to the Orbit to get close to Trent because I was already working for Steve Betts. He's holding something over me and I can't break free of him. He won't let me go. Her eyes widen.
You're working for Steve Betts and Trent.
I nod. Yes,
and neither of them know yet. It was just bets, and then Trent offered me a job, and I couldn't turn it down because it's my shot at getting out of Betsy's control.
Jeez.
She falls silent, and I can almost see her mind ticking through the implications. They're both users, I add. But Betts has the power to hurt my family. In fact, by using Pete Scothern as an insurance policy, he already has hurt them. And now Scothern is dead, and I don't know where they are.
You said you've spoken to Betts.
Yes. On the train to Nottingham. He admitted he sent Scothern to the house, so if I didn't deliver what I'd promised, dirt on Trent, he could blackmail me with my family's safety.
And what did he say about where Jen and Brody might be now?
He didn't admit he had them, but he said nothing would happen to them unless he gave Scothern the go-ahead, but I honestly don't think he knows Scothern is dead. The accident had only just happened when I got there.
Okay, let's see.
Eleanor rubs her forehead with the heel of her hand.
You said earlier that Jen doesn't know about the Orbit and Trent. She thinks you're living in a bedsit in Fulham.
That's right.
Well, let's just say Jen did manage to get away from Pete. Isn't that where she might have gone, if she has no phone to contact you?
It's like a light bulb turning on in the darkness of my mind. It's definitely possible, I say.
So give me the address. I'll go over there now and leave her a note while you wait here.
I'm so grateful to Eleanor for being practical when I can't find the strength to be. I text her the bedsit address and stand up. I'm going up to the penthouse now to speak to Trent. It's time to tell him about Betts, and I shake my head, not quite believing what I'm saying. I need to ask for his help. She nods.
Good luck. You can stay at mine and Hazel's tonight. I think you could do with the thinking time.
The lift glides to a stop before I can reach the penthouse floor. The digital screen flashes. Access denied. My pulse spikes. I press the button again, harder this time. I wave my key card in front of the panel, but it's not happening. Frustration knots my stomach as I take the concealed emergency stairs instead. The narrow, cold space is a stark contrast to the glass and marble grandeur of the building, but it gets me where I need to go. When I reach the penthouse door, I swipe my finger over the biometric pad. Nothing. I stand still for facial recognition. A small red light flickers instead of the customary green. He shut me out. My breath catches as I try again. The lock refuses me. Over and over, each failure a fresh slap. I'm locked out like an imposter. I press my palm flat against the cool wooden doorframe and force myself to breathe. Then I knock. There's no answer. A sharp panic edges in. I knock harder, call out.
Trent! Let me in!
Silence. The hallway is pristine, every inch of it polished. The mirrored console table I love is there, bearing fresh lilies as always. But the longer I stand in the enclosed space, the more this place feels like a high-end cage. Thick carpeting swallows any sound. The air smells expensive but artificial, and the cameras overhead blink, watching and recording my every move. I hate this. I hate how easily he can erase me as if I were never here. Saskia's face flashes into my mind, and I bang harder with a closed fist until my knuckles sting.
Trent! You have to speak to me!
A pause. Then, at last, the lock clicks. The door swings open, and there he is. Sleeves rolled up, jaw tight. Looking at me like I'm the one who's done something wrong. His voice is quiet and cold. You'd better come in. I step inside, but the unease doesn't leave me. Around me, the penthouse is as beautiful as ever. Vaulted ceilings, floor-to-ceiling windows framing the city skyline, but the walls feel closer than they should. This luxury is no longer a comfort.
It's more like control. And right now, Trent has it all, and I have none. Chapter 31. Trent. When he opens the penthouse door, Alicia walks in with what looks to Trent like a new confidence. She's wearing tailored trousers, heeled boots, and a cropped leather jacket that hugs her like a second skin. Simple, yes, but exuding a quiet, simple authority that's new. Yet there's something about her beauty today that makes his skin prickle, like stepping too close to a live wire. He's taken his eye off the ball with this one, but he tells himself this is his moment, his decision. He gestures for her to take a seat opposite him. Alicia sits, crosses her slim legs, slow and deliberate, and folds her hands in her lap. He thinks she's lost a bit of weight. Her cheekbones look even more chiseled, her long hair framing her stunning, understated features. She doesn't break eye contact, and he gets the distinct feeling she's under the impression she possesses some kind of power here. Trent straightens his tie, and he thinks about the first time he laid eyes on her, just a few weeks ago. He'd had high hopes for her back then, had believed she would help him gather some intelligence on bets and provide a nice little distraction while he got what he wanted. He hadn't been disappointed. The detail in the financial report she'd compiled had blown his socks off. He had to hand it to her. She'd come up with pure gold, exceeded his expectations. His best people had been unable to penetrate Betts's ironclad defenses through legal channels, so he had some searching questions as to how she'd landed such incriminating information. Now he had what he wanted. Alicia had served her purpose. She could be cut loose, just like he'd done with the others. What a relief it would be to finally drop the Mr. Nice Guy act. "I've been thinking," he begins smoothly, unfazed by her cool stare. "You know I think very highly of you, Alicia. After all, I recognized your potential, your drive. But recently, things have shifted. It's become clear that our shared vision of the future doesn't quite match." He watches her face, expecting a flicker of confusion, maybe hurt. But there is no such reaction. It's clear from her eye contact that Alicia is actively listening to him, but she's also managing to look unnervingly detached. "No hard feelings," she says coolly. "But hey, come on. I'm intrigued. How did you get that intel about Betts?" Alicia tips her head, a faint, almost imperceptible smile playing over her lips. "I never divulge my sources." Huh. There's that old Alicia attitude that attracted him to her in the first place. "What makes you think you're entitled to anything from me?" Trent blinks. For a second, he wonders if he's misheard her. Then he laughs, a sharp bark of disbelief. "What makes me think I'm entitled?" he repeats, leaning forward. His tone hardens. "Maybe it's because I own the penthouse you're currently living in, or the fact I pay you a ridiculously high salary. Or maybe it just comes down to the fact that I own this entire building and everyone in it." The words hang in the air between them, but Alicia does not flinch. She remains perfectly calm, her eyes still locked onto his. "Things have changed, Trent. Things you don't know anything about yet." Trent feels the stirrings of irritation growing stronger. He's always made it his business to keep smart and alert to what's happening around him. But he'll play her game, just in case she's going to reveal something interesting. "Let's hear it then. Time for you to be honest, Alicia." "It wasn't me I was thinking about." He leans back in his chair, spreading his arms.
"Then enlighten me. What the hell are you talking about?"
The silence stretches for a few long moments before she speaks. I gave you the chance to tell me the truth about what happened to Saskia Portman, she says, her gaze never wavering. And you lied through your teeth. Trent freezes, just for a second. Then he laughs again. Although this time, even he can hear it has a new forced, brittle sound.
I lied? About what, exactly?
He's struggling to keep the irritation out of his voice, but he's rattled. He is definitely rattled. You lied about everything. Alicia takes her phone from her bag and presses the screen. Trent looks down, and his blood runs cold. On the screen, grainy CCTV footage plays. It's the footage of him and Saskia, in the pool. There's no sound on the video, but he can hear her laughter echoing faintly in his head, the way it mingled with the ripple of the water. Then the scene shifts, the struggle. His hand on her leg, the sharp splash as her body hit the water. Oh God, he can still feel the sting of chlorine in his nose from that night and the sickly sweet smell of spilled champagne, sticky and clinging to his hands. He forces himself to breathe slowly. Anger will expose him, and the last thing he needs is to look like a man backed into a corner, even if that's exactly what he is. Trent lunges for the phone, but Alicia is faster. She pulls it back, holding it just out of reach. I can let you have a copy, but you can't have my phone, she says calmly. The original is quite safe. Trent's face darkens.
Is Betts involved in this?
He hisses. Alicia nods. That's how I knew the footage existed in the first place. He'd had a tip-off the CCTV was working the day Saskia died, and that you had a copy of the footage. You tried your best to bury it, but... She shrugs. Here we are. Trent's jaw tightens, his mind races, calculations firing. He can feel the fury bubbling beneath his skin.
If you've seen the footage, then you know I didn't kill Saskia. It was an accident.
Absolutely, she says. You didn't kill her. But you didn't help her either.
I did. I tried to resuscitate her.
And when it didn't work, you ditched her. Dumped her back in the water.
You didn't call an ambulance or the police. You only thought about your own skin, even remembering to clear away the evidence of your champagne glass. Then you buried the CCTV footage and lied to the police. It wasn't me who buried it, he says. I was blackmailed over the footage.
Alicia shakes her head. You're still lying now.
No,
he hisses, his voice low and venomous. He knows exactly how this footage has surfaced. Ingrid has always been shrewd. Paranoid enough to protect herself, which was why he'd been forced to make the deal with her.
Ingrid has access to all the rooms in the building. She hijacked the footage the night Saskia died, and I had to make a deal with her. A big lump sum and a job for life here at the Orbit.
Ingrid, she gasps. Now he sees the shock on Alicia's face before she swiftly recovers. You could have gone to the police regardless.
I had to think about the Orbit. We'd just opened. It would have been a PR disaster if the press got hold of the footage and...
That's just business, Trent. Saskia was a real person with a life, a future. She was someone's daughter.
You don't think I know that? I think about it every day. Every time I close my eyes, her face is there.
Alicia gives him a skeptical look.
What is it you want?
He asks finally, his voice a low growl. Alicia leans forward, her expression cool and unreadable. What do I want to stop me from handing the footage over to the police, you mean? His fists clench beneath the table, but he forces himself to stay composed. He waits. Her voice is softer now, almost conversational. First, let's be clear. Don't underestimate me, Trent. I can and will ruin your life without hesitation if I need to.
The press will be queuing up to speak to me if I put word out. He forces himself to stop grinding his teeth. He's so used to being the one in control, to pulling the strings of everyone around him. This reversal of power is dizzying and unnerving.
Tell me.
Alicia's gaze is steady on his. Then she smiles again, that ghost of a smile that twists into him like a knife. I want enough shares in your company to give me a controlling stake, and I want to live rent-free here in the penthouse. When you move out.
Move out?
Trent stares at her, stunned into silence. For a moment, the only sound in the room is the faint hum of the air conditioning. Then he laughs, a short, bitter, hacking noise.
You're insane,
he says.
You seriously think I'll do all that? Do you have any idea who you're dealing with?
Alicia's expression doesn't change. I know exactly who it is I'm dealing with. A man who thinks power is absolute, as long as he's the one holding it. But here's the thing, Trent. Power is transferable. And you're not holding it anymore. I am.
He stands abruptly, the chair scraping loudly against the luxurious marble floor tiles he personally went to Tuscany to select.
How meaningless that seems now. What a joke that he's fallen so far he's trying to justify himself to some waitress who's trying to screw him over. How did it come to this? But the look on her face tells him she hasn't finished with him yet.
I have a confession, Trent.
When I came here, I was already working for someone. Not Elevate, and not as a waitress. That was a smokescreen.
I see,
he says wryly.
Seems I'm not the only liar around here, then.
I've been working for Steve Betts for the last 2 years, gathering information for him. And you're my latest mark.
What?
He towers over her, his shadow stretching long across the table.
You sly little bitch.
But Alicia doesn't flinch. She remains seated and composed, as if this entire conversation is unfolding exactly as she expected.
You have no idea who you're messing with,
he says, his voice low, menacing.
This is dangerous territory, and you're way out of your depth.
Her gaze flickers to the screen of her phone and the paused CCTV footage. Am I really? Because from where I'm sitting, you're the one with everything to lose. He wants to lash out, to rip the phone from her hand and smash it to pieces, but he knows that will solve nothing. He knows only too well that the original footage is well beyond his reach.
So you've sold me out, am I right? You've told Betts about this CCTV footage? He's paying you well, is he? To destroy me? To destroy my Manchester plans?
Trent stares at her, his mind a whirlwind of rage and desperation. He's messed up big time bringing her here, into his life. He'd sensed from the beginning there was something different about her. Different and novel, he'd thought, but never dangerous. That's why he hadn't yet got around to looking into her background. He'd been too busy obsessing about how to get the better of Steve Betts. He's not paying me at all. Let's just say we've got unresolved history between us, and he's blackmailing me. If I don't do as he says, he'll hurt my family. Trent opens his mouth, and she holds up her hand to silence him. My sister and son have gone missing, and I think Betts knows where they are, but he's holding it over me to get information on you. Trent glances at the phone and back to her.
Okay, so cut to the chase. Where does all this fit together? Where do I come in?
Betts told me after this job he was going to cut me free, but I don't believe him. I don't think I'll ever be free of him. And I need to find out where my family is. She looks down at her hands, breaking eye contact for the first time. I wondered if you had any ideas how to help me. In return for the original CCTV footage.
You've got a big problem, and I'm not talking about me,
he says carefully.
I'm talking about Steve Betts. If he has anything to do with your family going missing, then you've got a very big problem indeed. He's in another league, you know that, right? He'd kill them and bury them deep without another thought.
Her face changes, and he knows he's hit the bullseye, found her weak spot.
Tell you what, I'll consider your terms, but there's something else that will help to serve us both.
She waits for him to continue.
I want you to bring Betts here. Don't mention me. Tell him I'm away. Tell him you've got what he needs, but you need to meet with him here. Up in the top floor suite, where we held the summer party. I'll block all the cameras out, so you won't be seen.
He can wriggle out of this mess. It's not too late to turn it to his advantage. He just needs to get his thoughts in line.
Okay, I can do that, she shrugs. Provided you get the shares paperwork done in time and agree to my terms, that is.
Then you get the footage back.
He nods, grudgingly impressed by her refusal to give an inch.
I'll call my lawyers now. As you know, they can move very fast when I need them to.
He'd got them in from their offices just around the corner when he originally asked her to sign the NDA. Giving up a few shares won't kill him. Not if it means getting his hands on that damn footage and ruining Betts. As she walks to the door, Alicia pauses, turning back to him and holding up her phone.
One more thing, Trent. If I sense you're planning something, if I catch even the faintest whiff of betrayal, this footage will be posted on every major social channel by the morning. Understood?
Trent doesn't answer. His jaw clenched so tightly, it feels as if his teeth might crack. To say he's underestimated Alicia just doesn't cut it.
Good, she says. I'll take that as a yes. And then she's gone, leaving him alone in the room. She thinks she has the upper hand, but she hasn't got a clue how far he's willing to go to protect what he has. Chapter 32. Friday. Jen. Jen steps out of the cab, tightening her grip on Brody. She's exhausted. Hours at the station, waiting for trains, dozing off and waking with a jolt. The rush of traffic roars past, horns blaring impatiently. The car radio had been droning on since they left the station. Some phone-in show, voices overlapping, a heated debate about something meaningless. It was a wall of noise, mixing with the blood pounding in her ears and the worsening panic clawing at her chest. Brody shifts in her arms, letting out a small whimper as she presses a kiss to his temple, her pulse racing. She has to keep moving. She has to find Alicia before Pete finds her again. Brody stirs slightly but doesn't wake. He's a warm, limp weight in her arms, his little body too light, too fragile. The infection and fever have wrung him out over the past week, leaving his usually chubby cheeks a little hollowed and his skin pale. His dark lashes fan against his cheek, his lips slightly parted, and Jen presses a kiss to his temple before shifting him higher against her hip. She checks the address on the letting agent's details again. This is definitely the place Alicia is renting, but it's not the London she imagined. The street is lined with peeling, graffiti-tagged fences and wheelie bins overflowing with rubbish. A couple of teenagers in hoodies loiter on the corner, watching her with vague disinterest as they pass a vape back and forth. The house in front of her is worse than some of the others. Peeling paint, rotten window frames, the front door scuffed and dented. Surely to God this is not where Alicia is living. All this time, Jen has felt resentful, imagining Alicia living it up in London while she's stuck in Nottingham dodging Pete's temper. All down to her own disastrous choices, granted. But this is a nasty little bedsit on the wrong side of town. Why would her sister choose to live here when she has so much cash to splash? Jen's head is thumping, her breathing hitched, but she steels herself and presses the doorbell. The silence stretches out, and Jen shifts her weight one foot to the other. Please answer. Please be here.
She rings it again, jabbing harder. Nothing.
Her breathing quickens. The longer she stands here, the more exposed she feels. She glances behind her, scanning the street. Pete could be anywhere. He's always had this way of preempting what she'll do. He could easily have followed her, if he'd managed to recover. When he crashed into the bathroom, he dragged her downstairs into the living room. Brody screaming, her yelling. His face. He'd looked so crazy. Truly crazy, like he'd lost his mind. The moment she swung the full weight of that metal giraffe sculpture into the side of his head, she'd known she was past the point of no return. She thought she'd killed him at first. But even with blood trickling down his face, he'd got to his feet, roaring her name, stumbling after her as she'd grabbed Brody, his changing bag and her handbag, and bolted. She'd made it to the main road and flagged down a cab, hands shaking, breath coming in ragged gasps. She'd glanced behind her to see Pete stumbling after her, weaving into the road and back onto the pavement, waving Brody's bunny in the air like a madman. She was already in the cab when she realized she hadn't got her phone. Pete had snatched it up in the bathroom, and she didn't know Alicia's number by heart. All she had was this address, scrawled on the letting agent's printout Alicia had brought home with her the day she told Jen it was happening. She was moving to London. She looks down at it now, fingers tightening on the crumpled paper. "Can I help you?" Jen jumps, spinning around. Brody stirs on her shoulder but settles back down again. A smiling young woman stands behind her, wheeling a bicycle and holding keys. With wild curls tied up in a messy scarf, silver rings on every finger, and a battered leather satchel slung across her chest, she looks like a friendly hippie, and Jen relaxes slightly. "Who is it you're looking for?" "Alicia Turner, my sister," Jen replies. The woman pulls a face. "Jeez, bad luck. Alicia moved out ages ago. Someone else is in her bedsit now." Jen rocks on her feet slightly and shakes her head. "But..." The woman studies her for a moment, her gaze flicking to Brody, still asleep in her arms. "Can I ask your name?" "I'm Amanda."
"I'm Jen, Jen Turner," she says.
"And this is Brody. He's Alicia's little boy." The younger woman's expression softens. "Fair enough, you passed the test. I was told I had to get your name before I spoke to you."
Jen frowns, her heart skittering.
"What?" The woman gestures toward the grubby door in front of them. "I have a message for you. Come inside."
Chapter 33. Alicia. Steve Betts clocks me the second I walk in, his gaze slicing through the dim light of the small cafe like a knife. He's hunched in the corner, sprawled out in that lazy way of his, but his eyes are cold and sharp, daring me to make this worth his time.
"You're late,"
he snaps, before I've even sat down. "I'm here now." I clear my throat to cover up the tremble in my voice. "You wanted an update?" His glare pins me to the chair, unblinking.
"Your family's gone missing and you think that's on me? If I'd taken them, you'd already be digging graves."
I shake off the horror of his comment and force myself to focus on what I came here for. "But you sent that psycho Pete Scothern to my sister's house, and you know he's the reason they're missing."
"Yeah, well, the knobhead's not answering my calls, is he?"
That confirms he doesn't know Scothern's dead yet.
"But I'll find out what's going on. Can't say fairer than that, can I?"
His expression darkens.
"Now, where's my update on your findings?"
"There is something, but I'm not sure what it means. I'll need to show you." Betts leans forward, his harsh cologne smelling stronger than ever, as if it's trying to mask something rotten.
"Are you winding me up, being so secretive?"
He glances around and drops his voice, low and menacing.
"What exactly have you found?"
I lean back, the edge of the chair digging into my spine, but I keep my face straight. I've searched his office, his files, everything. There's nothing there. Bet stares at me, his lips disappearing into a thin, mean line. His bulk looms across the small space between us. I thought I'd feel safe insisting we meet in this little cafe. But I feel far from that.
But you've got something, yeah? So what exactly have you found?
I'm not going to tell him about the CCTV. That's going to be what buys me shares in Trent's company. But Bet's suspicious eyes drill into me, and saying nothing will only make things worse. There was something. But I need to show you, to explain. It's worth your while, that's all I can say.
When? I haven't got time to mess around like this.
His snappy tone slices through my hesitation.
It's the council's decision next month, and I need something now, so I can do maximum damage from leaking it.
Tonight, at the Orbit, I say quickly. Trent's away until tomorrow, and there are no events on. It'll be quiet, and you can see for yourself. Betts leans back, his thin lips curling into a slow, cruel smile.
Well, well. Looks like you have been sitting on something after all. Give me a clue, at least.
I told you, it's complicated. Accounts linking him to shell companies for... I need you to see it, Steve. I'm sure you'll understand it much better than I can. He narrows his eyes.
It had better be good, Alicia. You owe me, and you know why.
The weight of that night 3 years ago presses on my chest. I feel it even now. His hand around my waist, his grin splitting his face. He thought he owned the world. I haven't forgotten, I say quietly. Betts's gaze is sharp and unrelenting.
You trapped me,
he spits. You trapped yourself, I snap, my anger rising through the fear. He slams his fist on the table, the sound thudding through the small cafe. Heads turn at nearby tables, and I look down at my hands, but Betts doesn't care.
I lost everything because you framed me,
he growls.
My reputation, my deals, my life. You really think you've got the upper hand, don't you? You've no idea what I'm capable of.
I don't think I have the upper hand at all, but remember your promise to me, I say tightly. If I pull this off, you let me go.
We'll see about that,
he says from behind gritted teeth.
You're going nowhere until I say so. Until you give me what I need to completely crush Connors.
He's never going to let me go. No matter what I bring him. I can see it in his face. Hear it in his voice. The tension feels suffocating. The air between us thick and cloying. Finally, he leans back and says,
8 o'clock tonight, at the Orbit. Mess me around at your peril.
I stand up quickly, my chair scraping noisily on the floor. You'll get what you want, just be there. I walk past the tables, my pulse roaring in my ears. Outside, the light is starting to fade. I stand, taking in the fresh air. I look around at the still busy street, people walking in different directions. My heart pulls. Where is my son? I have to do something if I don't hear from Jen soon. Betts is a liar and can't be trusted. He might well be involved in their disappearance. I cross the street, leaving the cafe behind. Tonight will change everything. One way or another, this all has to end. I just hope I'm the one left standing. Later. The artificial fluorescent glow of the Orbit's foyer fights with the natural light outside. I stand near the glass doors, my arms crossed, every muscle wound so tight it hurts. Steve Betts is late, and the waiting churns my insides. He's controlling the situation, controlling me, like always. My throat tightens with fury and helplessness. Barry, the doorman, gives me a guarded look from outside. He senses my nervousness, but knows to leave me be. I catch my reflection in the glass. I look haunted and pale, like someone who hasn't slept in days. My sister,
My son. I know Pete Scothern isn't a worry anymore, but where are Jen and Brody? The doors hiss open, breaking my thoughts. And there he is. Betts. His broad shoulders fill the space, a figure of menace entering the sleek, polished world of the orbit. He scowls at Barry like the man is beneath him. His suit looks expensive, but his loose tie and rumpled shirt scream carelessness. A man who's now too arrogant to care about appearances. I step toward him and get a whiff of whiskey. Been waiting in a bar since I left you. My snide remark slips out and I close my mouth quickly. I need to keep on his right side, for now, at least.
You've got some nerve,
he says, brushing past me toward the lift without breaking stride. My stomach twists with hatred as I follow him. This is it. He's here. And all I have to do is get him up to Trent and let him take care of the rest. The lift doors slide shut, trapping us together in the small mirrored cage. I flash my keycard at the digital pad, my hand trembling just enough for him to notice.
I've been doing a bit of thinking. Why would you drag me out here, Alicia?
His eyes rake over me with a disdain that makes my skin crawl.
I can't work out why you couldn't just tell me in the cafe what you found.
I look up at him, defiant, even amid my fear. I've got a question that needs answering first. Where are they? His head tilts slightly, amused.
Who?
Don't play games, I snap. My voice is sharp, but I know Betts will smell the fear like blood. My sister, my son, where are they? Betts shifts and leans close, so close I can feel his breath on my cheek. His voice drops a low, dangerous growl.
I've told you before, I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
My fists clench. You'd better not be lying to me.
Or what?
A slow, mocking smirk spreads across his face.
Listen, I put a guy on house watch, and he says the police have been at the property, but there's no sign of your sister or the kid. And Scothern's gone AWOL. I've had no contact. I might investigate a bit further, or not. Let's see what you've got for me first.
Cold, sick dread spreads through me. No sign of them. No contact. That could mean anything. Anything. But if Betts is telling the truth, then the situation might be even worse than I've anticipated. Because with Scothern dead, nobody will know a thing about where he might have taken them. I tighten